Hello? Arrested? It is my wife Jerry on the phone. A call to action. A lady in distress. What more powerful impulse could she have stirred in me? Casting personal risk aside, I dashed the six blocks back to our little year-old bookshop, the Nexus, to rescue her. Not for the first time and not for the last. As I stepped through the door, they arrested me too. What else? What might I have done on Friday, November 17, 1961, around 4:30 in the afternoon, had I foreseen this utterly obvious outcome of my heroics? Fled to the border, abandoning wife and children and dreams? Armed myself and had a shootout at 7405 La Jolla Boulevard? Maybe not.
You are listening to the Library Cafe, and that was La Jolla bookseller Lawrence McGilvery reading from the beginning of a memoir describing the events of the day in 1961, in which he and his wife Jerry were arrested and subsequently tried for obscenity for selling a classic of American literature, Henry Miller's Tropic of Cancer, to an undercover San Diego police officer posing as a student. I'm your host, Thomas Hill. Larry is with us today to tell us about that trial, which marked what was for him certainly a memorable battle in the most important case of literary censorship in the United States. This was the cultural and legal war over Henry Miller's novel, in which the censors were finally defeated in a U.S. Supreme Court ruling that once and for all put an end to legal assaults on literary works on obscenity grounds. That was the 1964 decision in the case Grove versus Gerstein, which Justice William J. Brennan Jr., writing for the majority, ruled that, quote, "Material dealing with sex in a manner that advocates ideas or that has literary or scientific or artistic value or any other form of social importance may not be branded as obscenity and denied constitutional protection." Yours wasn't the only trial, was it? There were many more.
60-something. It
Yes.
was a new tactic. It was a new tactic where instead of having one case go up through the courts and be dismissed or not, all these jurisdictions all over the country were being targeted by ambitious police chiefs, in my case particularly, and by censorship groups like the Citizens for Decent Literature or its subsequent offshoots. And it probably was not a national conspiracy. But it certainly was a very definitely coordinated attack. These groups were in touch with each other, and the police chiefs were in touch with each other, and they were in a panic. The McCarthy era was over, and yet the remnants of it were still with us.
The book itself, Tropic of Cancer, wasn't something that had just been published. It had come out.
1934. In France, because it couldn't be published here because of the obscenity laws then in effect. This was prior to the famous case of Ulysses, James Joyce's Ulysses, where a much less restrictive definition was issued by the Supreme Court.
And although the novel was banned in the U.S. and Britain, I understand it was well received by readers in Europe and elsewhere in the 20-odd years before the trial.
Well, it certainly was published freely enough there. There were pirated editions in Scandinavia and probably elsewhere, Japan, I think, maybe.
So the police came knocking on your door and arrested your wife?
My wife, who had a nursing baby, we had bought the store almost exactly 1 year earlier, on November 15th, 1960. We bought it from a man named Robert Van Doren, who had opened it a year before that and who was tired of it.
This is in La Jolla,
This is in La
California.
Jolla, California. And before that, we were living in San Francisco, and my wife had said to me one day, "Why don't we open a bookstore?" And she wanted to move to San Diego, and so we had spent several months coming down occasionally and looking around for a place to establish such a bookstore, and the only place was La Jolla, and there was already a bookstore like this there. So the last day, when we had effectively eliminated the last possible alternative, we went out to this shop to buy a few books, and in conversation found out this guy was tired of having this store. And the upshot of it was that we ended up buying it for, as I recall, $2,000, half of it borrowed, which gave us the name and the clientele and the stock and the lease on a $125 a month rental on the busiest street in La Jolla, although not a good pedestrian street, and we were on our way.
And it was called the Nexus Bookstore.
It was called the Nexus when we bought it, and I did not like the name. It had too many negative connotations to me. Noxious Nixon. Those were all, to me, very negative connotations.
Funny coincidence, you know, the first book of Henry Miller's later trilogy,
yes,
Rosicrucifixion, is called Next.
Yes, I know that. And the librarian who named it, Bob Van Doren, mm-hmm. apparently, he claimed, did not know the book. He was going back to the original Latin, which means connection.
And your shop was also an art gallery?
At the La Jolla Boulevard mm-hmm. store, we had a carport. It had a roof of corrugated plastic on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we had art shows there. And as it happened, on that day, the November 17th, 1961, the art show we had up was some gorgeous photographs of Ansel Adams.
I asked in part because I know Henry Miller was an artist, a watercolorist, as well as a writer.
I think I asked him once for some of his watercolors, but I don't think he ever sent me any.
So had you read Tropic of Cancer yourself at the time you were arrested?
I had read it, and my wife hadn't. To this day, I don't know if she ever did read it. I just called her sister the other day, and she said that she had never talked to her about it, and two of my three daughters, she'd never talked to them about it, and I think she never talked to me about it. I think she probably never read it.
So you mentioned that the assault on the book across the country wasn't done through the normal channels of due process, and that it involved police intimidation?
Police intimidation and also pressure groups. There was I don't know if it was the CDL or other groups, but they had lists of books they did not want booksellers to sell. And they went around pressuring booksellers to remove these books from their shelves. And I'm sure that our predecessor probably refused to cooperate with them.
You know, it seems when you think of the times, the beginning of the 1960s, the 1950s hadn't yet entirely passed by into the rearview mirror, had they?
It still is the end of the 50s.
But there's a desire in American society to finally shed the repressive, reactionary, fear-based cultural and social drivers of the 1950s.
Yeah.
And then Henry Miller, even though his major works come out of the 1930s and he has, some would say, a 1920s sensibility, he becomes a figure of cultural liberation for people. Kerouac and Burroughs and the Beats look to him as a literary father figure.
The book starts like this. I am living at the Villa Borghese. There is not a crumb of dirt anywhere, nor a chair misplaced. We are all alone here, and we are dead. Last night, Boris discovered that he was lousy. I had to shave his armpits, and even then the itching did not stop. How can one get lousy in a beautiful place like this? But no matter. We might never have known each other so intimately, Boris and I, had it not been for the lice. Boris has just given me a summary of his views. He is a weather prophet. The weather will continue bad, he says. There will be more calamities, more death, more despair. Not the slightest indication of a change anywhere. The cancer of time is eating us away. Our heroes have killed themselves, or are killing themselves. The hero, then, is not time, but timelessness. We must get in step, a lockstep, toward the prison of death. There is no escape. The weather will not change. It is now the fall of my second year in Paris. I was sent here for a reason I have not yet been able to fathom. I have no money, no resources, no hopes. I am the happiest man alive. A year ago, 6 months ago, I thought that I was an artist. I no longer think about it. I am. Everything that was literature has fallen from me. There are no more books to be written, thank God. This, then? This is not a book. This is libel, slander, defamation of character. This is not a book in the ordinary sense of the world. No. This is a prolonged insult, a gob of spit in the face of art, a kick in the pants to God, man, destiny, time, love, beauty, what you will. I'm going to sing for you, a little off-key, perhaps, but I will sing. I will sing while you croak. I will dance over your dirty corpse. To sing, you must first open your mouth. You must have a pair of lungs and a little knowledge of music. It is not necessary to have an accordion or a guitar. The essential thing is to want to sing. This, then, is a song. I am singing. And that sets out the rationale for the book. He wants to upend the old ways, and this was, I think, as much a danger to the people who wanted everything to stay exactly the same as the emphasis on sex. I should interject here, by the way, that Lady Chatterley had been through the same kind of problem, and it had been cleared by the court. But trotic cancer is another step farther in the direction that was just a pressed all the panic buttons, on top of which it was also ideologically offensive, not just in terms of language and sexuality.
You'd mentioned Grove had published the hardback edition a few months before the paperback came out, and there wasn't much opposition to it. But it's when the paperback comes out that these conservative forces become alarmed. And it is interesting, I think, to note that Miller's audience isn't just the literati, either in Europe or America, but that he appealed to people of all classes and interests. He was read in Europe avidly by working people, and GI smuggled his books home during and after the war. And so, you know, I wonder if that didn't fuel the alarm when the paperback came out. The fear that the book would have a real influence on the culture at large.
Definitely. Yeah. The cloth book was $7.50, which was very expensive for a novel at that time, probably almost double. And it was selling very well, but the problem was that the book had been published in France. Mm-hmm. Miller was an American author. The typesetters' unions had gotten a clause in the copyright law stating that a book by an American author had to be set in type in the United States to get its copyright protection. Mm-hmm. And Tropic of Cancer had not, nor had any of his other books that were published abroad. And so it effectively was in the public domain. And a publisher of mass market paperbacks decided to put out the book. Another publisher actually printed an edition mm-hmm. of the book, and they were going to distribute it. And Rossett, he had no legal recourse.
That's Barney Rossett, owner of the Grove Press.
He finally made a deal with them where if I read it correctly, I think he paid them $30,000 and got the printed sheets in exchange. And then he had to create the first 32-page signature over again with his own imprint on it and the cover. And the first edition has on it, this is the complete unexpurgated Grove Press edition originally published at $7.50. It was a black cap book, the first one, I believe, 95-cent cover price, which also was about double the cost of such books at the time. And he promoted it as the authorized edition, the one that Henry Miller was actually getting royalties from. Yeah. And that was in about August of 1961. And at that point, these cases began erupting all over the country. And it was very, very effective. It was not like somebody getting arrested in New York or Los Angeles or someplace, and then the book going through the courts and going up to the Supreme Court. It was being adjudicated in all these different municipalities and different states with different laws. And the law at that time in California was based on a previous Supreme Court decision, and it said, in effect, that the book, its primary subject had to be sexuality, excretion, etc., that it had to be beyond customary norms, and most importantly, this is important, and that it had to be utterly without redeeming social value. That was the key to the California law. And that was not the same law in other states. There was a guy in Michigan that I read about, a bookseller who got 6 months from a judge who would not admit any expert witnesses to come. And so at the time we were arrested, there already were two other cases in California. There was one in Marin County. In that case, the jury thought the book was obscene, but they acquitted the man on the basis that he hadn't been responsible for it. In the Los Angeles one, a man named Bradley Smith, interestingly enough, there are two Bradley Smiths. One of them is the author of Japan, a History and Art, and Mexico, History and Art, and a book on Henry Miller, of all things, an illustrated book on Henry Miller. And the other one is this bookseller on Hollywood Boulevard, who was taped selling a copy of the book, slavering over how dirty it was. And that was the one that went up through the court. And then there was ours.
So did you sell the book then meaning to test the law?
No, we sold it because it was available. It was selling well. We couldn't get it from the paperback distributor, so we bought copies directly from Grove Press. So we got copies of the paperback. At that time, and this may still be the case, the mass market paperbacks, mm-hmm. the ones you find in drugstores and supermarkets, were handled by magazine distributors. They were not handled through normal book wholesalers. And so we were dependent upon the local wholesaler, Hopkins News Agency, to get all these books. And they received 6,000 copies, according to my best information. And they held them for 6 weeks and then returned them. And as I understand it, Barney Ross had offered them indemnity, and they refused it. And they notified the chief of police about it. Now, the police chief was Elmer Jansen. He had been police chief for quite a long time. And he had some ambitions in mind. His ambition, subsequently realized, was to retire in January of 62. This is just a few months later. Mm-hmm. And get appointed to the position of sheriff of San Diego County. The then sheriff was retiring in January. And then in the election in November, he would be the incumbent. So that is part of the background. Somebody had delivered a copy of Tropic of Cancer marked up with dirty passages. So there were all sorts of rumblings going on once the paperback came out. I believe there had been maybe one or two or three actions somewhere in the country on the cloth-bound book. Nothing ever happened about it in San Diego or Los Angeles, anywhere in California that I know of. There was a man named Richmond Barber who wrote for the Evening Tribune. The San Diego Union and Evening Tribune were both owned by the Copley Press, which is a very, very reactionary chain of newspapers. Mm-hmm. And the Tribune had this columnist he was a lonely heart psychology philosophical writer and a would-be censor, and he was widely regarded as a joke. People read him for entertainment. Mm-hmm. And he had a habit of writing rather titillating articles. Here is an example of one. He wrote about Tropic of Cancer three times. The first one was in November 2nd, 1961, a Wednesday. He was to have been a witness for the prosecution, but he pulled out, which is too bad. Either he feared quite rightly what we might do to him on the stand, or the city attorney decided his testimony wasn't worth the baggages he brought with him. But the most entertaining and one of the most persistent elements in his column was titillating letters from husbands whose wives had exhibitionist tendencies. And either this phenomenon, which I wouldn't have thought was a problem, was much more prevalent than most of us would have thought, or Barber himself had a prurient interest in nudity. We would have had a lot of fun with him. Here's one example from Saturday, December 2nd, this one where he first took on Tropic of Cancer. Question. I was raised in a straight-laced Iowa community. My wife was raised in an easygoing, immoral California family. We are 27 and 32 years old. She does things which shock me. For example, she never wears a nightgown. She walks around the house with nothing on. She isn't bothered when our neighbor looks in and sees her. Her new kick is pornography. She got started by reading Lady Chatterley's Lover. Then she bought Tropic of Cancer. She asked me to read it. I tried but was nauseated. Now she has loaned both books to that neighbor. Is this a healthy situation? Won't our neighbor get ideas about my wife? What can I do? Here is the sage answer. Of course your neighbor will get ideas. Start by buying your wife a house coat and insisting she wear it around the house. People who do what she does can be arrested for indecent exposure. I am sorry that both Lady Chatterley's Lover and Tropic Cancer have been approved in some high courts. The first book is evil enough. The second one is incredibly bad. I believe they are both pornographic. I suggest you lay down the law to your wife about the books she reads. Your marriage may be at stake. A later letter under the title Bad Blood supposedly was written by someone who had believed in freedom of speech until he or she went to Tijuana and bought a copy of Tropic of Cancer. After reading it, the writer's opinion had changed. I couldn't even finish the book. It made me too sick. It is a very poorly written, detailed account of a morally depraved man's debaucheries among the decadent prostitutes of Paris. I think the police were right now. Have you read that book, Dr. Barber? Of course he had, as the writer must have known. It all sounds like the baldest kind of setup to produce one more column on the book. That was the opening salvo. And the next thing that happened was 9 days later, on Friday, November 11th, the Union says 6,000 copies were returned by Hopkins News Agency after holding them for 6 weeks. The article closes with Jansen declaring it shocking and obscene after reading a few marked-up pages. He could not finish it. He revealed the shipment of the book as a warning to anyone attempting to display the book or sell it under the counter. Let the return of these copies be a warning to San Diego booksellers not to sell or display copies of Tropic of Cancer. Now, we didn't see this. By the time we heard about it, by the time somebody came in and mentioned it to us, the notice did not appear in the Evening Tribune, mm-hmm. and we never did find a copy of it. I have only a very bad photocopy from microfilm. So this was what we knew about it, was that he had issued this warning in this very haphazard way, And on Monday, we called the ACLU, and they said, well, there is this case going on in Los Angeles, and we may not be able to help you, and you should probably take it off sale. Mm-hmm. There was one copy left on the shelf. On Saturday, we'd sold whatever remaining stock we had to people who came in, mostly lawyers. And on Monday, a very pregnant woman came in and bought a copy. And on the following Wednesday, a young man was there, as I recall, at noon when we opened. Mm-hmm. He absolutely had to have this book for a journalism class at San Diego State. And we tried to offer him, oh, I think of Mice and Men and Catcher in the Rye and I don't know what else. And he was very insistent he had to have this copy. So we argued with him for at least 20 minutes. And finally, we did not carry used books. Mm-hmm. But there was a box sort of sitting, not really out of sight. It wasn't behind the counter. It was next to the counter underneath a shelf where there were some used copies of paperbacks that one customer bought in. And sitting there on top of it was a copy of Tropic of Cancer. So I picked this out and I said, you know, we're covered by the state law. I knew what the state law was. One of the defenses for a bookseller was if you sold it for educational or scientific purposes. Yeah. So we finally sold it to him for 50 cents and did not charge tax, gave the 50 cents to the owner of the book, and the next day we were arrested. The arresting policemen were polite and very insistent. Do you have any photographs? I took him out to the art gallery mm-hmm. and showed him Ansel Adams. He says, that's not what I meant. And do you have any controversial books? I showed him Conscience of a Conservative. Barry Goldwater's very controversial. He said, no. And he said, what's this? And my wife said, why, that's Anna Karenina. Tolstoy's great novel. And the police work was unbelievably sloppy. Mm-hmm. They came armed with Jane and John Doe warrants. They did not have our names. Mm-hmm. We had business licenses. We'd had them for a year. Mm-hmm. They didn't have our names. They didn't have a search warrant, fortunately, because we had a lot of copies in the back. We lived in the back of this little building, and we had copies, had several cartons back there. So they didn't really search the store. They looked around a lot and tried to find something incriminating, and of course couldn't find it because it wasn't that kind of store. Yeah. So we were both under arrest.
Yeah. Did you take away in handcuffs? Or
No, not in handcuffs, but it was 4:35 in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. We had a nursing baby. Some friends came in and stayed there with our daughter, Lynette, who was 4 and a half at the time, and kept the store open. And they took us down in two cars. They took Jerry in the police car, and the other police went with me in our VW. And we drove down to the city jail. They booked me. I was only there for 45 minutes, I think, long enough to get served tea and a meal, which I gave away. By the time we got there, our bail was already there. Our angel in this case was Harvey Furgetch, F-U-R-G-A-T-C-H, a prince of a man, if ever there was. He was a very well-to-do developer. He had a passion, an absolute passion for the First Amendment. I don't know if he was the then president of the ACLU, the San Diego chapter, but he had been. He was,
yeah.
And the ACLU had this big case in Los Angeles, and he took care of everything. He found us the lawyer, and he had told us to call him if anything happened. And so we called him. He was there when we got there. I was out on bail. We went over to the women's jail, and Jerry was in there for 2.5 hours. They gave her the entire treatment as though she was a streetwalker who'd been running off the street, delousing and showering and prison clothes. And then the woman refused to believe that she had bail waiting for her and went off to dinner. And so we were outside for 2.5 hours trying to keep our daughter Erin happy. And finally we got out. And then that was the beginning of it.
And you have a copy of the law in your notes there you were arrested under?
Here's the heart of the municipal ordinance under which we were first arrested. It shall be unlawful for any person to act in, pose for, model for, make, write, compose, stereotype, print, design, copy, or otherwise prepare or cause to be prepared any obscene, indecent, or immoral writing, paper, article, book, pamphlet, picture, photograph, drawing, cast, image, or figure, or, B, to circulate, sell, or exhibit, all those foregoing things, or to have in his possession for any lewd or immoral purpose, all the foregoing. And there isn't a single word of definition for the obscene, indecent, immoral, or lewd. And one can suppose that they intended the police to arrive at these delicate distinctions between what was protected and what was not protected. And it also looks as though a woman could have such material and not go to jail. And the fact that the mere possession of such material could bring 6 months in jail shows just how extreme it was. But and it was purely unconstitutional.
So had you received a letter from Barney Rossett and the press assuring you they would provide for your defense if you were arrested? I'd read that they had sent such letters out and did indeed defend some booksellers.
If we were, it may be in a thick folder that I haven't been through yet, but I don't remember ever getting it. It occurs to me now over 50 years after the fact that the police must have been under great pressure to make an arrest, particularly to arrest us. The newest, least experienced, and they thought the most vulnerable book dealers in the county. They knew the law as well as we did, and they understood that we would be protected by the educational exception. Yet they sent their undercover student in exactly that guise. And if I'd had the wit to get a statement from, there probably never would have been a case. But we'd been in business for a year. And, you know, we were young and naive and way too trusting. And we didn't know until the testimony in the trial whether it was the student or the pregnant woman. We didn't think it was anybody else.
Yeah.
Okay. After we were arrested. And on top of it, we were just about to move into one of the most desirable properties in La Jolla, one of the original Scripps houses, on a third of an acre of lawn overlooking the ocean, two doors up from the museum, from the art center, the then art center, now the Museum of Contemporary Art, and a beautiful, big, rambling place called the Wisteria Cottage for a 40-foot walkway that leads up to it from the sidewalk covered with wisteria. We were just about to move into this, and, you know, the owners were Dr. and Mrs. Roger Revelle. Ellen Revelle was a Scripps by birth, and Roger Revelle was the head of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography and the founder of University of California, San Diego. And they backed us. They backed us all the way. So we moved into this new building actually it was January 8th, I think, that we finally got open. And you know, I spent over four months in a sort of limbo while the case sort of went underway. It sort of got its steam up. And Harvey Purgatch, our angel, had found us a lawyer, a man named John F. O'Loughlin. He was a lapsed Catholic. He'd never had a civil liberties or civil rights case. He was a criminal lawyer. He was sort of a cornball. He was a very sort of sharply dressed cornball. He had a very commonplace way of speaking that allowed him to connect well with juries. And I was scared to death.
You were how old at the time?
27.
20, yeah.
I was scared to death. I thought this man is going to lose the case for us. Ever we'd go and see him, and he'd just talk to us for 5 minutes and he'd send us on our way.
So at this time, did you feel you were just hoping to save your skin, or were you taken up with the wider import?
No, we were going to see this through. It was only a misdemeanor. So we could have gotten out of it very quickly, very easily. But it was not the kind of thing we would do. And they misjudged the situation. So we would go and see O'Loughlin, and he would sort of brush us off until 3 days before the trial was about to start. And then he was incredible. This case, the way he presented it, was, I think, quite possibly the most remarkable censorship case that has ever been tried.
You mentioned the press was involved in the weeks leading up to the arrest. Were they involved after the arrest?
There was a lot of funny stuff,
yeah.
A lot of amusing stuff. Yeah. There were letters to the editor on both sides of the issue. There were articles on both sides of the issue. Between November 21st and Monday, April 9th, 1962, at least 28 articles appeared in the San Diego Union, the San Diego Evening Tribune, the San Diego Independent, the El Cajon Valley News, and other papers. Two of them stand out for very different reasons. On Wednesday, November 22nd, Cy Cassidy, who was the publisher and editor of the El Cajon Valley News, and the El Cajon is a very conservative neighborhood, but he was a fabulous, handsome man who was the liberal's liberal. He sounded a lot like Mark Twain. Well, it looks like we're going to have a good old hair-pulling, umbrella-swinging rhubarb in the courts on the question of obscenity. You could sort of feel what was coming a week ago when Police Chief Elmer Jansen of San Diego announced that he was laying for anyone who tried to sell copies of a book called Tropic of Cancer by Henry Miller, and so forth and so on. And then in the Union for Sunday, December 10th, entitled Booksellers' Views Varied on Tropic, three booksellers and one librarian either adopted a neutral tone or decried police censorship. The first one quoted, Vern Warrenbrock, took a decidedly different route. Selling this book is ridiculous. The only possible excuse for selling it is to make money on pure filth. If that isn't obscene, nothing is. It's just as harmful to people as dope. People want to buy morphine, too. Well, that was his opinion. Yeah. This is Vern Warrenbrock. He was the owner of the largest and oldest used bookstore in town, Broadway and 8th in San Diego, right on the main street of San Diego. And he was widely known as the reliable place for people to buy the really hardcore stuff.
Oh, that's interesting. Fortunately
for him and unfortunately for us, he did not appear on the stand as an expert witness. We would have crucified him. Yeah. Oh, this was funny. There was an article in the Evening Tribune on January 31st, 62, from now Sheriff Jansen, about a letter that had been sent by Cosmo Book Sales of San Francisco, which was a house that specialized in adult literature. It was sent to Frank H. Notbush, presiding municipal court judge. J.D. Mercer of Cosmo Book Sales wrote to thank for its sales of 6,000 copies of Tropic of Cancer as a direct result of the numberless local attempts to ban it here and throughout the USA. The pamphlet listed unusual adult sex books, gay-colored physique art photos, and nude statuettes. Mercer's letter said in part, "We wish to express our thanks to those who have been active in book burning and book banning. They have aided Cosmo Book Sales to become an established, successful mail-order house in less than 2.5 months. On the December 12th, we were rearraigned under the state law, which is the one that had the thing about utterly without social value. And we asked for a trial by a judge, but the prosecution refused, so we ended up with a jury. And Sheriff Bert Strand of San Diego County retired on January 7th, 1962, and Elmer Jansen was appointed to fill out the remaining year or so of his term, thus making the incumbent in the election would follow in 5 months. The trial started on April 9th, 1962. A group of about 40 La Jolla housewives banded together and came to keep the store open for us.
That's interesting.
Yes, they were really wonderful. As it turned out, Jerry did not need to be at the trial because it was a misdemeanor. So the 3 days before that, we had been cramming for this case. Mm-hmm. O'Loughlin had appointed me his co-counsel, more or less. I guess he did have a co-counsel, yes. He did have a co-counsel, but he and I became a team. An unlikely pair, unlikely as it might have seemed. We became a real team. He relied on me for the literary material. And he relied on himself for the strategy, and his strategy was simply brilliant. His strategy was to take the most objectionable parts of the book and build his entire case on them, and it worked. It worked for reasons because the book supports it. I have recently...
So he did a close reading of the book, essentially, as a defense.
He did a very close reading, and he came to conclusions. I haven't read by any means all the criticism on Miller, or much of it. Yeah. But I have never read any critic who came up with the things that he came up with.
So how did the trial proceed?
Well, first of all, let me give you the cast of characters. There is John F. O'Loughlin, our attorney. Mm-hmm. There is Martin Gutfleisch, the opposing attorney for the city attorney.
Gutfleisch.
The prosecutor. Gutfleisch, right. He is a Henry Miller devotee. He has read The Rosy Crucifixion, which I've never laid eyes on.
And this is the prosecutor.
This is the prosecutor. But this doesn't come up at the trial. And the Los Angeles trial has already taken place. And he went there, I think, and witnessed part of it. Mm-hmm. The Los Angeles trial was a fiasco. They called as witnesses Leon Uris, the novelist, and Dr. Frank Baxter, who was a very, very popular TV, I think. Yeah, Shakespeare on TV was his program. Very popular TV personality. And I think I must have read the transcript of some time or other. It was like a circus. It was like a Roman circus. And the defense was very badly handled. A salesman from Grove Press, a young guy who was, we liked him, but he was utterly irresponsible. He'd picked out the lawyer. And they didn't call a single woman. Well, this was a big deal. the prosecuting attorney was able to say, well, you know, this book is so bad that they couldn't even get a woman to stand up for it. And it was a slam dunk. There was no way that Bradley Smith could have gotten off. So this was the background, that the Marin County case had been settled on a technicality. Bradley Smith had been found guilty in Los Angeles, and we were the next sacrificial victim. And Gutfleisch went into the case believing in his heart of hearts that no jury could listen to this book and the language in it and not be deeply offended by it, so deeply offended that they couldn't possibly find it not obscene. So, as I said, we'd been cramming for this. And the night before, I made up a list, three sets of words, technic words, vagina, penis, etc. Mm-hmm. Slang words like whore and clap and so forth, and then the four-letter words. Mm-hmm. And I gave this to O'Loughlin. So he started off, we found out later, a panel of 47 specially selected jurors. They'd selected people who were not professional jurors, who had not been on many cases before. Mm-hmm. And the judge, who is the third person, and cannot remain unnamed now, was Judge Edward J. Schwartz. We could not have asked for a finer judge. He was absolutely splendid. He wanted this case to be tried. He wanted the whole question to be opened up completely. He gave both sides tremendous latitude, which we used and they did not. And he ran a perfect trial.
It must have been interesting, you know, from a strictly legal perspective.
Well, he later on said it was one of the most interesting cases he ever tried, and I'm sure it was. So here we have these 47 people, and O'Loughlin starts questioning them one at a time. They all can hear the questions. And he asks them questions like, have you ever heard of Dr. Richmond Barber, who writes for the Evening Tribune? Oh, yes. Well, if Dr. Barber appeared on the stand here as a witness, and he said that this book was absolutely, without question, obscene, would his opinion so sway you that you wouldn't be able to consider any other evidence? And the juror would say, well, no. So this did two things. First of all, it eliminated Barber as a possible witness. And second, it put the jurors in the position of declaring themselves open-minded at the beginning.
Yeah, that is interesting.
And have you ever heard of Dr. Frank Baxter? You ever watch his program? Oh, yes, yes. Well, he's a very well-known TV personality, and so forth and so on. So this continued. The jury selection took 2.5 days. So then after the first several jurors, he took this list out, and he said, now, would the mere presence of this kind of language in this book so influence you? And he read vagina, penis, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no. And he was very nervous, and he went through to the second, you know, after a few more jurors, he went to the second list, and then finally to the third list, which, of course, was where we were headed. And at some point, well, when they were called up for questioning, two women disqualified themselves. This is very important. They said they did not want to be associated with this kind of book, and the judge excused them. And we excused people, and the prosecution excused people, and, you know, it was just a guessing game. But, you know, we were trying to gauge what was going on, and there was one woman that we found out that her brother-in-law was a policeman, and O'Loughlin really wanted to get rid of her. But she also was a ceramicist. And I said, no, we want to keep this woman. I just had a really good feeling about her. So we kept her. And so we finally got to the end of this, and we ended up with 12 jurors and one or two alternates. And I think we went through about 36 of the 47 people, as I recall. So now the trial itself starts. Well, the first thing that happens is that the jurors have to read the book. So the judge said he did not want to rely on their reading the book themselves. He wanted to have it read to them. So each side can present their own reader. And they got a young man, a young attorney from the city's attorney office, and we supplied a wonderful young woman named Renee Crew. She was the matronly mother of four, and she also was a devoted Miller fan. She read all the books. And it was to her farm, by the way, out in Sorrento Valley, which then was out in the country, that we took our stock of Tropic of Cancer that had been in the back of the store when the police came on November 17th. And so now we have a man reading the book and a woman reading the book. and a very sympathetic woman. And moreover, a woman who can tell us how the jury is reacting, and does tell us. Mm-hmm. And so I sat in the first half hour of this, and I don't know how I did it, but I said, look, this is not working. They have to have the book in front of them. This is the first actual day of the trial.
Okay.
And so I guess I said this to O'Loughlin, and he went to the judge, and he said, well, you know, we think that they should have copies of the book. And the judge said, well, that's probably a good idea. Where do we get them? And and O'Loughlin said, well, we'll supply them. So there was some funny stuff in the paper. One of the headlines was, copies of banned book supplied by no one. And it had a very humorous article about how these copies had appeared, and the judge was pleased they were there, and he had no comment about where they'd come from, and so forth and so on. And so they read through the book. One of the most objectionable parts in the book is an episode where a character named Van Norden, a very, very lusty guy, has a prostitute in bed with him and discovers that she is shaved. And he has never seen this before. And he gets a flashlight, and he gets under the covers, and he starts examining her with the flashlight. And this pornographic arc, this was what O'Loughlin noticed.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the perfect example to explain this. Miller, throughout the book, sets up these pornographic arcs that come up just to the climax, and then stop, and he uses them as a springboard to launch a 7 or 8 or 10 or 12 page screed on philosophy, disquisition on philosophy. And so we learned that two of the women in the jury just practically collapsed laughing during the reading of this passage. And moreover, during the trial, during the actual testimony, every time that passage came up again, they had to practically smother themselves to keep from bursting out into laughter again.
Well, some people would call Tropic of Cancer comedy, actually. You know,
it's very comedy.
It is.
It's very comedy.
Yes.
So we got to the end of the reading, and there were 6 men and 6 women, an average of 45 to 50 years of age. 3 of the men were from Convair. 1 was at Ryan. 1 was retired. The women all seemed to be housewives, although one of them was a ceramicist. The most commonly read magazine was the Reader's Digest. And the humor of the book seemed apparent to all of the jurors. The first witness was Stephen Wayne Smith. He was the supposed San Diego State College student. And our friend Dana McCarthy, the cross-dresser. The copy that he bought was a copy of Dana's. We did not sell used books, but Dana occupied a special position in the universe of the Nexus.
Yeah.
And he was in the habit of buying a book from us for retail and reading it and then bringing it back and tossing it in a box. And we would sell it for him for half price. And a few days before the ultimatum came down, he had come in with Tropic of Cancer.
Hmm.
And he had tossed it in this box on top of all the other books with a sort of dismissive comment. He hadn't liked it very much. And that's where it sat until Stephen Wayne Smith came in. And on the stand, he denied being persistent about the Tropic of Cancer and that we tried to offer him substitutes. But we did learn that he'd been given a $20 bill to buy this book, to buy it under the counter, and that when we charged him 50 cents, he just dug in his own pocket and pulled out a couple of quarters and paid us, and that they reimbursed him for it. And on the stand, I later testified that after some discussion on whether to simply loan him the book or sell it to him for 50 cents, we sold it for 50 cents. No tax, no profit. We gave the 50 cents to Dana. And then the arresting officers, Patrick Rose of the Vice Squad, and Sergeant LeBus, Glenn LeBus, added a little, apart from denying that they had harassed us about supposed dirty books and pictures. The first actual expert witness was Millie Crum, the force behind the discredited municipal ordinance and a clubwoman who'd made a career for herself by carrying a satchel of hardcore pornography all over the county and lecturing on it. The marked copy of Tropic given to Police Chief Jansen almost certainly originated with her or with one of her associates.
Mm.
And that brings us directly to organized censorship in the U.S. in the late 1950s and 1960s.
Mm-hmm. With Charles Keating, our friend.
Yes,
from the,
Charles Keating.
Our friend from the big banking scandal.
Lincoln Savings and Loan.
Yes, yeah.
The one who brought down John Glenn Alan Cranston and John McCain and two other senators. He was a lawyer. He was a swimmer in his youth. He was a financier, a real estate developer. And in 1956, he began giving passionate letters in Cincinnati on the evils of pornography. He testified before the House Judiciary Committee that pornography was closely associated with juvenile delinquency, that it was part of the communist plot. So he formed the Citizens for Decent, well, I think it was originally the Catholics for Decent Literature, and then became the Citizens for Decent Literature, and then the Citizens for Decency Through Law. And they had, I think 300 chapters and hundreds of thousands of members. And then he got involved in big real estate deals in Texas and then in Arizona, and he bought Lincoln Savings and Loan and engaged in very shaky financial manipulations that ended up costing the federal government, $3 billion directly, the Federal Insurance Fund, and something like $5 billion in total. And then the a loss of between $250 million and $288 million to investors, who were many of them retirees, who lost their life savings in this disaster. Lots of them people living in retirement communities in California, where there'd been a big push to sell these bonds, these very safe bonds. That's the background in which we find Mrs. Crum situated. Yeah. And we had expected this mad woman frothing at the mouth about juvenile delinquency and the communist conspiracy and so forth, and she wasn't. She was a very attractive, well-groomed woman who was very contained and very positive of herself. She had stated publicly, "I consider Tropic of Cancer obscene from the first paragraph of the first page to the last paragraph of the last page." So O'Loughlin asked her to read the first paragraph and the last paragraph out loud in court. Now here they are. You've already heard the first one, but I'll repeat it. It's very short. "I am living at the Villa Borghese. There is not a crumb of dirt anywhere, nor a chair misplaced. We are all alone here, and we are dead." That's the entire first paragraph. And the entire last paragraph is, "The sun is setting. I feel this river flowing through me, its past, its ancient soil, the changing climate. The hills gently girdle it about. Its course is fixed." Period. The end. And he asked her if she found anything funny in the book. And she said no, she didn't find anything funny. Well, that cut her value as a witness, as an expert witness pretty badly. And O'Loughlin managed to use her positions for our benefit, as he did throughout the entire trial for almost everybody. He asked her if she had a sense of humor. "I'm Irish, sir," she replied. And he asked, and about that final thing, "The hills gently girdle it about. Its course is fixed. Did you find that obscene?" "No, sir, not in itself." The second witness was one of her clubwomen friends, whom we managed to she just had nothing to say. They would typically spend 20 minutes or a half hour giving their credentials, and then Gutfleisch would ask them, "Have you read the book? Do you think it's obscene?" "Yes," without delving into it. He was lazy. When Dr. Lester Bond, a minister and former army chaplain, a short, portly man with white hair and a military bearing, strutted to the stand, he resembled nothing quite as much as a powder pigeon. He had been with the Boy Scouts since 1910, the American Legion since 1920, and on and on. We were going to let him off easily. And then we found out that he was a past president of the Council of Churches. And let me explain why that was important. O'Loughlin demonstrated through Bond's testimony that he had agreed to become a witness for the prosecution before he had read the book. At a Council of Churches meeting in October, the month before our arrest, someone had announced that there would be trouble with Tropic of Cancer, and they needed witnesses, expert witnesses, and Dr. Bond had volunteered. So O'Loughlin asked him, "Did Dr. Bond know that Walker Scott department store on Broadway in downtown San Diego had carried Tropic of Cancer and had displayed it in their window?" "No, he didn't." That shook him, because George Scott, one of the dominant figures in San Diego for decades, had been Dr. Bond's immediate predecessor as president of the Council of Churches. When O'Loughlin began exploring Dr. Bond's understanding of the seamier aspects of the lower depths, it turned out that he had been in Paris and New York once each in his life. In Paris, he had gone with some other ministers to Montmartre one evening as a study group to examine the street life. In New York, he and some other army chaplains had driven down the Bowery in a closed car. O'Loughlin finished the testimony with a simple question. Did you ever read any hardcore pornography before? Of course not. In that case, how can you compare Tropic for Cancer with it? And he mumbled something in reply, and he went out. He was dismissed one very deflated individual, and how this man ever counseled soldiers with genuine problems, I cannot imagine. Now we come to the most interesting witness in the entire trial, Father John Ahern. This is Good Friday, April 21st, 1962, half session in court. He had been suggested to me as a possible witness for our side. He was a man who knew American literature backwards and forwards. He was an honest man, a very fair man, a man who tried to consider things in their totality, and he was a man through whom we could introduce all the stuff that we would otherwise had to wait for our own witnesses to introduce, like the critical opinions of Henry Miller. For instance, we could introduce the opinion of Carl Shapiro in a magazine called Two Cities Review that starts off, "I call Henry Miller the greatest living author because I think he is. I do not call him a poet because he has never written a poem. He even dislikes poetry, I think. But everything he has written is a poem in the best as well as in the broadest sense of the word," and so forth and so on. Then O'Loughlin could ask him, "Do you know of Carl Shapiro?" "Yes, of course I know Carl Shapiro." "Is he a respected critic?" "Yes." "Is Two Cities a respected review?" "Yes, it is." "So could reasonable men differ on this topic?" "Yes, they could." So we kept him on the stand. It was a very friendly cross-examination. We never had to put the screws on him because he was very forthcoming. And we went through this over and over again. So it was now 12:15, less than that. And there was still something that we could not quite get our fingers around. We couldn't quite get in our grip. Something in his testimony that we needed to bring out. And O'Loughlin was questioning him. I was sitting there listening to all of this. I was trying to figure out what's going on. I finally, as I recall, I wrote out a set of 5 or 6 questions and I handed them to O'Loughlin. And there were questions that had to do with he kept talking about the balancing. He thought that the bad in the book outbalanced the good. And O'Loughlin looked at the questions and sort of nodded, and he asked him these 5 questions, and we did not want to bring him back on Monday. At 12:55 or 12:50, we had proven to everybody in that courtroom that he had not understood the law. Yeah. Gutfleisch had not prepared him properly. Yeah. He had not understood that it had to deal with sexual matters and excrements and so forth, that it had to exceed contemporary standards, and that it had to be utterly without redeeming. I think that they chose him for that day on purpose, putting a Catholic priest on the stand on Good Friday. I mean, it just is too much of a coincidence. Yeah. And it turned out later on that the jury apparently returned to his testimony again and again. He was our best witness. And this was all due entirely to this brilliant strategy of O'Loughlin's, of using the most objectionable parts of the book to build a case. So on Monday, we had a Dr. Butterfield, who was a very poor witness. There was a prosecutor at presented a black attorney from their office to represent local standards, and the judge threw him out. We had a black juror. It was a bold attempt to influence that juror.
This notion in play when the question of community standards came up in these statutes of how to define a community. And if they were presumably local, it necessarily meant community standards was a term as open to manipulation as a term obscenity itself.
Well, the judge ruled that out at the beginning of the trial. And then their last witness was a Reverend Robinson, who was just absolutely sincere, and he was a true believer, and there was simply no way of dealing with him, and we just just had the mildest little cross-examination. So now we come to our turn, Eleanor Widmer. Eleanor Widmer had a PhD. She and her husband, Kingsley Widmer, were both literary people. She had come up from the bottom of the Lower East Side. She wrote a book, an autobiography called Up from Orchard Street. And she was a characteristic New York Jewish intellectual, mm-hmm. with everything that would signify. She was lots of people didn't like her. My wife didn't like her because she was very full of herself. I adored her. Mm-hmm. I thought she was a wonderful, wonderful character. She was not above claiming credit for anything that she thought she deserved. She was smart, incredibly smart. She and her husband had written a book on censorship, and they also, I think he may have himself had written a book on Henry Miller. Mm-hmm. He did not want to be a witness because he thought it would be too prejudicial, and he also thought we should have a woman witness. And I was scared to death, again. I thought, you know, she's going to come across as this brassy New York Jew. La Jolla still, at that time, they still had a system of yellow cards to keep people of Jewish extraction out of La Jolla. She and Kingsley had gotten there. He was very WASP, and he had gone in and rented a house without their ever seeing her. And it was an issue. She was very poised. Gutpleist just licked his chops when he saw her. He subjected her to a brutal cross-examination. He made her read passages, the worst passages in the book, mm-hmm. one after the other, after the other. Would you let your son read this book? Well, not until he's an adult. Would you recommend it to so-and-so? Well, I would have to know them better. So forth and so on. O'Loughlin had divided, we had three witnesses. He had divided the book up into three categories. One of them was Miller as the writer, as the witness of his times. The second one was Miller as a philosopher, of whatever you think of the philosophy, but Miller as a philosopher, and also with a very strong religious bent to his writing. Mm-hmm. And the third was Miller as seen by the literary world. These three witnesses. So Eleanor handled Miller as a writer. Mm-hmm. She said, for instance, that he wanted to expose hypocrisy, that he was on a pilgrimage of self-discovery, that he, at the end, that beautiful passage about the river, at the end he is still searching and still alone. And the book had a terrific subterranean audience before Grover ever put it out. It was widely smuggled from Paris. I think I brought one from overseas. Yeah. One of the highest points in the trial was Eleanor's umpteenth reading of a salacious passage. This one in a dance hall where Miller maneuvers a willing American woman, she was actually, out into the vestibule, and they can't make it work. We wriggle into the cabinet, and there I stand her up, slap against the wall, and I try to get it into her, but it won't work. And so we sit down on the seat and we try it that way, but it won't work either. And Eleanor ad-libbed, "The story of the three bears." The courtroom, it was 3 minutes of solid laughter. Gutpleist kept a straight face during this entire scene. How he did it, I do not know. But it was just one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. And there's a little to this story. Eleanor became the queen of restaurant reviewers in San Diego. She wrote for the San Diego Reader. For years, she had a weekly column along. They gave her a whole page every week. And she had an inquiry once.
Oh, okay.
She said, on March 3rd, 1977, she wrote, "In May of 1975, I received a phone call from a public relations man who asked me to visit a Mexican restaurant, Si Señor, in La Mesa. I softened when he told me that the restaurant was owned by an attorney, Martin Gutpleist. Could this be the same man who had taunted and goaded me and done his best to unnerve me in the Tropic of Cancer trial? He was, of course, and a fellow New Yorker to boot. The two of them became fast friends, and they explored restaurants in San Diego and Tijuana together until his death in 1987. We called in a couple of booksellers from Walker Scott, that same department store that I mentioned before, and from May Company, who testified that they'd had the cloth-bound book on sale for quite some time. And on Thursday, April 26th, Barbara Collins, a young English teacher from Cal Western University, another woman, I will note, was our second expert witness. She was a very quiet, pleasant woman of about 27 with two children, I believe. Her role was to explain Miller's philosophy and his essentially religious outlook. She spoke at least an hour and a half, and Gutfleiss wisely chose not to give her any more time to further damage his case, because Eleanor had damaged his case seriously on his cross-examination. Mm. The third witness was Robert Kirsch, who was the book reviewer for the LA Times. And Gutfleiss was delighted when he saw Kirsch, because Kirsch had testified in other trials, and he was able to portray him as a gun for hire. But that didn't have much effect either. Then suddenly, on that Thursday after Kirsch's testimony, we were out of witnesses, and suddenly I had to go on the stand. And O'Loughlin did not want me to get into the actual arrest, the actual sale of the book, until the next day. So I had to spend about 2 hours describing in minute detail how you ordered books and what the layout of the store was and how we arranged them on the shelves and all this kind of thing. And I wasn't a very good witness. Gutfleiss managed to get me angry. But I read aloud from Mitchell Goodman's novel, The End of It, an anti-war novel about the invasion of Italy. And in that novel is printed in verbatim, in full, the famous speech that General Patton, George Patton, gave to the troops, which is worse than anything in Miller. And I, during my testimony, I read this passage to show that here was this book that had been published with no comment whatever, and it had something in it that was worse than anything in Henry Miller. And I'd let Gutfleiss bait me a bit. I'd come close to losing my temper a couple of times. And Jerry's half hour on the stand, Jerry, my wife's half hour on the stand, included two wonderfully comic moments. O'Loughlin asked her in an uncharacteristically muddled way if on the morning of Wednesday, November 15th, a young man wanting to buy a Tropic of Cancer had identified himself as a police cadet. Startled, she replied, "Why, no, sir." Again, there was an uproar in the court because that was the whole issue. That he hadn't identified himself as a police cadet. And O'Loughlin explained sheepishly that he had been getting by on 3 hours of sleep during the trial. And again, Gutfleiss was not amused. For years, I accepted O'Loughlin's excuse at face value, but now I think I underestimate the man that he had this planned. Here was a way he could point up the bad police work and the whole mess surrounding the entire arrest. And she told that story about Anna Karenina, and that got a huge laugh from the jury and from the audience. And Gutfleiss had to handle her very carefully because she was a very sympathetic witness. And at least one woman juror who probably was against us from the beginning visibly warmed up to us during her testimony. And that was the end of the trial, except for proving that the book was not banned by the post office, and closing statements. On Monday, the 30th of April, after the closing statement, Judge Schwartz made his charges to the jury. This is important. There were three possible routes for acquittal. One, that the book clearly was not obscene in our opinion, my wife's and mine, and that we therefore had not knowingly, in quotes, sold obscene material. Two, that even though obscene, we had sold it, we thought, to a student with a legitimate educational purpose. Or, three, that the book itself was not obscene under the law. He told the jury that they should deliberate only on the last point to begin with, whether the book was obscene. If they found the book obscene, then they should take up the second defense, and only then, if they were undecided, consider the first. They went out at 2:15 on Monday and did not return their verdict of not guilty until 5:45 p.m. the next day, Tuesday, May 1st, 1962. Judge Schwartz didn't ask how they arrived at it, but he said that he agreed with it. As it turned out, on March 4th, a man named Kenneth Rinker, who was juror number 11, I believe, the jurors are numbered 1 to 6 on the back row and then 7 to 12 on the front row, left to right. He came and spent 2 hours telling me about what happened in the jury room. He said that from the moment they entered until the moment they left, there was not a moment of silence. The foreman was chosen very quickly, a very commanding presence, a Scottish man who worked for Convair. He was one of the what they called the alien workers. They were people who were not citizens and couldn't process classified materials, and they put them to work on non-classified things. And he was something else. That night, after the verdict on the 2nd, he gave an interview in which he talked about the book as a parable of what happens to people who fall into these awful paths of depravity. Mm-hmm. He found a whole element in the book that we hadn't put in there. A Good Flesh was just fit to be tied about this. Yeah. And he performed a very important role. The initial vote was 4 for acquittal, 2 against, and 6 undecided. And he himself, this Kenneth Rinker, was one of the undecided ones.
Yeah.
And he was quite sure that number one juror, the one, the ceramicist, was one of the ones for us. And he thought that Robert Young, the foreman, was probably one of them. And it was just an enormous process they went through. They had to be sequestered. They were put in a hotel overnight. And they came back and back and back to Father Ahern's testimony. And they looked through the end of it, the Mitchell Goodman book with the George Patton speech in it. And Robert Young, the foreman, found a rape scene in it that I'd completely forgotten about it, that he read to the jury and that they thought was worse than anything in Miller. And it wasn't, it had no four-letter words in it, but it was so violent. Because, you know, one of the things that these laws never talk about is violence. Good Flesh was overconfident. He thought for sure he was going to win this case. He told me after the jury was in session, he told me that we had been targeted in error. And he had not prepared his cupboard of witnesses properly, especially Father Ahern. And there was also the problem he faced of that if he was too hard on us, it would turn us into martyrs. They never addressed items 1 and 2 on that list from the judge. They were determined, apparently, to decide the facts on the book, which is what Judge Schwartz wanted.
So that's amazing. Then you made close readers out of the jury.
Yeah. And Rinker said that he and I think other jurors felt that they'd been given a crash course in literary criticism, which they were.
Yes.
And Good Flesh hadn't realized until my testimony that we were not the original owners. It was after that that he told me this, that they targeted us in error.
But you had been selling the book, it's just that you were sold out?
We had a monopoly on the book, but we didn't have any copies. Well, we had the copies that were in Sorrento Valley, and we sold those out within a day or two, and then didn't have any for weeks because Grove Press didn't send us any. The police began blustering about arresting anybody who sold it again.
You mean after the verdict?
After the verdict. They said, well, just because a person commits a crime doesn't mean you can't arrest them if they commit the same crime again. Yeah. And there were 128-point headlines in the San Diego Union announcing our acquittal.
So was there television coverage as well as the newspaper coverage?
Well, there was this interview with the foreman, and I think I was on the same show later on. And then when we were selling the book, the TV crews sent a cameraman out to show us selling the book, you know, sort of waving this in their nose. And they finally backed off because the city attorney finally said, we're not going to prosecute any more cases. And then one more interesting thing happened. The election was held. Former police chief Jansen, now Sheriff Jansen, on June 5th, 36 days after our acquittal, and he had the endorsement of every influential organization in the county, and he was the incumbent thanks to his appointment 6 months earlier. In a field of candidates, he nearly won the primary with 48%. His opponent with 24.3% was Joseph O'Connor, the respected but underfunded police chief of El Cajon, an eastern suburb of San Diego, which is where the Valley News was. 6 months later, in the general election on November 6, 1962, Jansen was predicted winner with 2/3 of the vote. O'Connor had little public backing, and the actual election seemed only a formality. After Jansen's appointment as sheriff in January 1962, 3 things had happened. There was quiet but perhaps widespread dissatisfaction that he was double-dipping, getting both his public pension and the sheriff's salary. Then there was our trial, and his waffling, his attempt to bully us after the trial was over, the unfairness of it, the outcome, and the sorry handling of the case by the police in the first place. And then 2 or 3 weeks before the election, Jansen, who was absolutely unmistakable, one you'd have recognized two blocks away, checked into a hospital in La Mesa or El Cajon for some relatively insignificant illness under an assumed name. The evening of November 5th, one of O'Connor's, the challenger, one of O'Connor's most devoted backers, called to ask the spelling of my name. O'Connor's chances were so dismal that he and a few other friends were going to write me in on the ballot. Then the votes were counted. Jansen got 49.5%. O'Connor won with 50.5%, and I received 13 write-in votes for sheriff of San Diego County.
So do you have any words of wisdom after all these years about what you learned from this passage in your long career and your long association with artists and writers?
I was reading the book on the plane yesterday. Mm-hmm. First time I've opened it in over 50 years. And it is a wonderful book in many ways. The writing it is splendid.
Yeah.
Yes, he's excessive. Yes, he goes over the top. This is what artists do.
Yeah.
And he said he didn't have to worry about whether he was an artist. He says, I am one. And he was one. Is he the greatest American writer? No. But he is a very important American writer. And these people, they blew it. They blew it, picking on D.H. Lawrence and Henry Miller and so forth. They opened the doors up for the stuff that they were really trying to eliminate. The outcome of this trial was due to two things in particular. It was due to O'Loughlin's incredible strategy, which I doubt has ever been duplicated in any other censorship case, and it was due to the determination of Edward Schwartz to have a fair and complete reading. And, you know, if we had been unlucky, we were lucky. And we were lucky in our getting a lazy prosecuting attorney who thought he couldn't lose this case.
Yeah.
And we were lucky in getting a good jury and getting Robert Young as our foreman. And this terrific guy, Kenneth Rinker, who told these remarkable tales about what went on in the jury room.